Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining. This is Talk with Kenny. I'm getting some feedback here. I've got great callers on the line this evening. We have Eric Fabris, Jerry McVeigh, and somebody else who I'm not quite sure who they are, but Eric and Jerry, are you there?
Yep.
Hi. Hi there, Lauren.
Hi, man.
Hi.
How come I've never ever met you?
I'm not sure I can answer that. I've also got somebody from the 202 area code. 202 area code, who is this?
Yvonne Smith.
Hello, Yvonne Smith. What a powerful lineup of people to begin. Thank you all for calling. So the topic of the evening is going to be involuntary outpatient commitment laws and the ways in which they impose on our human and civil rights, and that they are human and civil rights violations for people who are subjected to them. Eric, would you like to start and tell us a little bit about some of the work that you've, let me just say that for anybody who may not be aware of what involuntary outpatient commitment laws are, these are laws that states impose that allow a judge to make a decision about one's medical treatment, or so-called medical treatment, as to whether or not they have to comply with a psychiatric treatment plan, and there are very loose criteria as to what determines these. In Canada, I believe they're called community treatment orders. Is this right?
That's right.
Okay. So Eric has done a phenomenal amount of work, and as has Yvonne and Jerry over the years in different ways to try to protect and promote the human rights of people who are involved with psychiatric systems. And so I'm wondering if you'd each take just a couple of minutes to introduce yourselves, and then maybe a conversation will naturally evolve after that.
Sure.
Eric?
Yeah, start? Okay, I just wanted to say thanks for having me on, Lauren. This is great. I'm glad somebody's talking about CTOs, IOCs, as you guys call them in the States, and I hope there's more conversations like this. And I also just want to say hello to the co-guests. Glad to see other people are working on this. It's such a huge thing because, you know, when you're talking about drugging on the ward, it's pretty simple. You kind of think, well, you know, people get detained. They get put into these places under lock and key. Basically, there's a lot of rules that get broken in those wards, basic human rights, and even some of the legal rules around detaining people under things like the Mental Health Act. And, you know, the expansion of that practice of just drugging people, you know, to get them out of distress, whatever the intent is, to restrain them, it just got bigger when in the 70s and later, many states and many provinces here in Canada started enacting these involuntary outpatient committals and these community treatment orders, because what it did was it basically took those practices and gave them girth outside of the ward. It gave practitioners in psychiatry more powers to drug people off the ward, whether that be like going to people's houses and forcing them to take medications there, or just, you know, going to people's abodes and telling them, if you don't take this medication, I'm going to have to take you back into the hospital. These things basically make it easier for psychiatrists to impose these treatments on more and more people. So my thinking is that it's a dangerous thing, and we need to speak loudly against it.
Well, I think that's a really good overview, Eric, and thank you. And I'm going to have some questions for you in a minute. We also have a caller from area code 409. I'm sorry, 419. Caller from 419, are you there?
Hi, Lauren, it's Pat Risser.
Hi, Pat. Great. If you can just hang on, I would like, Yvonne, would you be willing to introduce yourself and say a little bit about why you, what your interest is in this?
My name is Yvonne Smith from the Recovery Group in Washington, D.C., and we have assisted outpatient treatment in the District of Columbia. At one time, up until 10 years ago, it was open-ended, so a person could be on AOT for the rest of their life. The reason why I'm against it is because it adversely affects people. People don't understand that AOT is not treatment. It's a judicial procedure. The orders can be so specific as to the type of medication, where you go for treatment. I knew, for example, people that were had assisted outpatient treatment that didn't work because specifically they were mandated to go to a specific a day treatment program. If the orders say to take a specific drug and your doctor changes or something that's involved, or even if it doesn't change, and if for some reason you need to change it, they have to go back to the judge to change those orders. So it really gets in between the person and what their decision-making is. It's very dangerous to have this because there's really not not a necessity for it. If a person, in my eyesight, if you're able to live in the community, you should be able to make decisions of your own. And it's rampant to have a lot of misuse.
Absolutely. And so we're hearing a lot of danger out there, as much as they'd like to call us dangerous, that we perceive this law as dangerous.
People don't understand with some new legislation that's talking about making it a federal offense, like in the District of Columbia, because of our unique situation with Congress, if you are the AOT and they and you break your agreement for forced treatment, they can take you back to the hospital, and actually, U.S. Marshal can come and get you. So actually, if we have federal laws, if AOT becomes something that's federal, not just state, then you have a whole new law enforcement arm. You're involving the police, U.S. Marshals, and a whole bunch of other people enforcing people to do something that will be harmful to them.
This is for no crime committed, right? This is for
There's
somebody
no
who is not complying with a quote-unquote crime. Sorry.
You just might have behavior that other people think is strange. Maybe, and it varies from state to state, as you said. It could be as simple as you're not paying bills on time, or a complaint of a neighbor.
Yeah, this is dangerous.
Very dangerous. Spousal abuse. You could have. I just saw a piece on TV today with Dr. Phil, and a man was saying he just wanted his wife to get help. It was obvious that he's an abuser, and a lot of spouses would be subject to, because maybe they had postpartum depression or something else, it puts a lot of people at risk, people who may not even have a mental health history.
Right, and people don't realize that this literally could affect everyone. I mean, while there's specific criteria for the laws that you have to have some recent history with psychiatry, it's very, very easy to be institutionalized twice in a 2-year period, in a three-year period, especially with the way people are quickly, you know, in and out, admitted and discharged in rapid succession of each other. It's very easy. This could happen to everyone, and I think that, especially looking at like issues that veterans are experiencing coming back with post-traumatic stress from having to witness and be part of things that are hard on human nature and the way that the vets are being drugged. Paula Kaplan's work, I mean, everybody should be looking at. And then also, as you mentioned, women like with postpartum depression. So somebody who, you know, after childbirth is experiencing this. And so this can be everybody or anybody. Jerry, would you? Thanks, Yvonne. Jerry, would you please say a little bit about what your perspective is and some of the history of the work that you've done?
Okay. I personally have been committed, 5 times? And I'm right now, I'm looking at the B.C. Mental Health Act is gone off.
And B.C. is
That's the British Columbia. It's the western state in Canada. It's B.C.'s the province on the west of Canada. It's just north of Washington State and California State. And in Canada, there's the federal laws and the provincial laws, and the federal government looks after things like lighthouses and the Mounties and look after federal things. In Canada, everything to do with mental health is a concern of the provinces. So the Mental Health Act is written under the jurisdiction of the Health Ministry.
Okay.
And at the federal level right now, the federal level judges get involved. At the federal level right now, the Parliament of Canada is amending the criminal code, or are trying to amend the criminal code to deal. When you get into the federal system, you've got rights. C-14, there was a someone who cut off somebody's head on a bus, and he entered the federal system, and he's got rights. Right now, he's out on day parole. He was not guilty because he was insane, they said, or because of whatever that one is. And this was just a few years ago. When you get into at the provincial level, the Mental Health Act covers everything. And in BC, in the Mental Health Act, there's a section of the Mental Health Act that you can't sue anyone. If they do
that
it in good
sue
faith.
Anyone.
Pardon? You can't sue anybody. You can't sue the psychiatric hospital. You can't sue the doctor. You can't sue the cops. If they do something under the Mental Health Act, you can't sue them. If they do it in good faith and with reasonable care. And reasonable care is the same sort of thing as reasonable doubt. Like, you know how many criminals get off because it's hard to prove reasonable doubt. So nobody has ever sued them.
And you've been doing this for a long time, working for this human rights movement, Jerry, right?
Well, no, I've been working. I'm basically working for this mental patients survivor movement. Okay, right now, I've. What's happening to me? I've never taken meds in my life. I was diagnosed with bipolar in '91, and due to circumstances, I have never taken meds. I came out of the hospital, and I never got my prescription filled, which gave me time to research psychiatric meds, and said, God, I don't want to take any of those things, so I haven't taken them, ever. I was committed 2 years ago because I was one of those awful psychiatric people. I wasn't taking my meds. Oh, I was crazy, and I should be locked up. So they locked me up. And I've made a complaint to the College of Physicians and Surgeons, and it takes time for it to go through circles. But I'm going to nail them eventually. But it's going to take time. Okay. Okay. Because nobody sues them. It's right in the act that when you get committed to a hospital, psychiatric hospital, you have to have your charter rights read to you. They don't do that. Like, it's right in the act that they should do that. But nobody does. Huh. It just doesn't happen. Because, why bother following the act if we're not going to get sued?
What's the incentive?
Okay, when they read your charter rights, they're supposed to give you a form with the charter rights in it. And the idiots up here have added to the charter rights. One of the rights is that you can't refuse meds. That's right.
That's your right. Your right is that you can't refuse meds. Right.
Yeah. And it,
wow.
And it's
yeah.
Wow. You know, like, and once you get hooked up to the, once you get hooked up to the system, you can't refuse meds.
Well, and that's your right.
Jerry,
I'm going to have a lot to ask you in a bit. Thanks for that great overview. You have the right that you can't refuse to take your meds. Pat, would you introduce yourself and a little bit about the work that you've been doing over the years?
I'm Pat Risser, and I've been working for about 30 years in the human rights field. I was hospitalized over 20 times, including time in state hospital. Most of those were following a suicide or just indicating that I felt suicidal. Eventually, I figured out that I was being hospitalized for having a feeling. And I said, I don't think I want to do this anymore. I figured out that I didn't need to be locked up in a hospital to get help. And I discovered the peer self-help movement. And, ever since, I've sort of been fighting against that system that locks people up for having feelings.
Well, that's, and I know that you've done a phenomenal amount of work around the history of our movement dating back for centuries. So from that perspective, would you just say a sentence or two about what that experience has been like for you learning and what is the prime fact that people should know about the long history of this movement?
Well, there's the whole concept of parens patriae goes back to the ancient Romans and Greek times, where if somebody was suicidal or not feeling or being themselves in accordance with, the ancient laws or whatever, then the government had a role to take care of people. It was their job to look after the citizens. And if somebody was, flipped out, it was their job to go try and fix that. And so they substituted their judgment for the judgment of the individual. The problem is that, we've been sort of misled about, feelings and how we, some feelings, men, for instance, experience just as much trauma and sexual and physical abuse as women, but men are not allowed oftentimes to express feelings about that. We're supposed to be tough, have tough sports and all kinds of things where we're not really supposed to even feel pain or anything else. So we've got a social burden of trying to take care of people who the government feels are somehow unable to take care of their own lives. But it's built then on a whole system of lies, because their system is created on the back of psychiatry. Now, every other branch of medicine, when there's something wrong with somebody, you can identify that wrongness and make attempts to fix it. Psychiatry, there is nothing wrong with you physically. It's all based on emotion and feelings. And so you get locked up for having a feeling or having an emotion. And that's not something that medicine can fix, but psychiatry wants to claim some legitimacy, and it's been quite a battle ever since. I was going to say, I got locked up most of the time for saying that I felt suicidal. What I should have gotten might have been, you know, some support, some understanding, some talk, some work through the feelings. You know, all kinds of other approaches would have worked, but what they did was they locked me up. I came to realize that being locked up doesn't solve those issues. And you know, part of the problem that people don't understand is happening right now is that we already have civil commitment laws on the book right now in every state. People can be, if some judge rules that you are a danger to yourself or others and you have a mental illness, they can lock you up against your will. The problem, I mean, there are many problems with it, but it starts off with, first of all, the judges listen to and rely on psychiatrists who render that judgment. And then the judge taps his gavel and goes along with it, and you end up locked up and deprived of your liberty and your rights. Well, now what they're trying
I'd like to interrupt if I could.
I was going to talk about AOT for just one second.
Okay.
The assisted outpatient commitment that they're trying to get passed now, first of all, it's not an assistant and it's not anything that is related to treatment. What it is it's forcing people to take medication. And I can say that quite simply because we don't have, because we've already got on the books ways to lock up and label people and force treatment upon them. Those means already exist. This is trying to get people to take medications out in the community voluntarily. They want to use the fear of a judge, the fear of the black robe effect, to try and get people to voluntarily take their drugs out in the community. And it's absurd to me because I went in the hospital, I would cheek my meds, hide them in my cheek and not take them. What makes anybody think that out in my own home, all of a sudden, because some judge taps his gavel, I'm all of a sudden going to gain great new insight and start swallowing these toxic pills because some judge has tapped his gavel? Well, I mean, why wouldn't, if I cheeked him in the hospital, it just seems absurd for them to think that I'm all of a sudden going to have this great new insight and start swallowing the pills in my own home. And that's
part of the problem, Pat. I think because you're making a lot of really good points, and part of the problem is that people are being given a shot, and so it stays with them, and that there is no choice, and they're forced into the shot, The idea that these drugs are poison is very important. And with informed consent, if somebody wants to take it, you know, do whatever you want. It's your body. But, you know, when it comes to issues of coercion or uninformed psychiatry or court-ordered psychiatry, that these things are and that they find ways to have us ingest them. I want to get to Jerry because Jerry wanted to say something, but I also heard Yvonne in the background agreeing. Yvonne?
Yeah, I wanted to say something, too, about there is no evidence that AOT, or it's not a service, it's a judicial process, is any more effective. In fact, most of the research on AOT talks about things like less involvement with the police and things like that. So there is no evidence that forcing people to be in treatment. I know people that have been hospitalized 15, 16 times, and AOT doesn't work for them, having someone forcibly take. And you have to understand that it might not be that the person might not mind taking some medication, but they may have for some reason not want to take some specific item. So really it puts, as Pat was saying, that black robe effect, that really is very dangerous because it takes all of that. Even the doctors find that they have problems. I remember a guy who was taking a particular antidepressant that made him have an erection. And the doctor had to wait to go to court because to change the medication. So it can be very specific, and there's no proof that this. All the research is usually about violence. And the fact is, if you're going to be, like what Pat was talking about, if you're going to be committed in a hospital, for example, and that's not AOT, then, and it's against your will, there is going to be violence there. But there's no
right.
proof that it can work. And it takes the doctor now has to talk to the judge.
Right. And you know, and I really, I want to make clear that this is disproportionately affecting people who don't have money, for starters. You don't find many rich people who are being involuntarily outpatient committed or, committed for that, and certainly not to state facilities. And then it's also seriously with gross overrepresentation of people of color. And so institutional and structural racism is at the base of a lot of what's going on. And in the Duke study, which was the report on Kendra's Law, because of the overrepresentation of people of color, specifically of black men, aged 35 to 47 years old, I believe it is. But African Americans are three to eight times more likely to be court-ordered into services, five times more likely than whites statewide. And so the Duke study said that... you know, whether you see this as racism or if you see this as a human rights violation or as something positive is determined by whether you see psychiatry as helpful or harmful. And they said that the reason that African Americans were overrepresented was because African Americans were more likely to be poor, more likely to be in state services, et cetera. But then on page 32, it says that the part of the reason is because the people who are subject to this law are people who have been institutionalized, and there is clear overrepresentation of people of color in institutions. And so we have to get back to issues in a larger society about institutional and structural racism and classism and gendered thinking and,
And with recent
humanity.
Law, they really are talking about having federal, Department of Justice and criminal. One of the people that advocate most strongly for ALT is the Association of Sheriffs. That's one of the associations that advocates very strongly for that. Here where I live, we have at least two mental health courts, and they have a clinic right there in the courthouse, so they can take you before the judge, and they give you a choice, like the black robe effect. You can go. So if you got a person that's very vulnerable, and you can tell them, well, you can go to D.C. jail for maybe some minor offense of loitering or whatever. Typically what happens, a lot of people don't understand, is not necessarily that everyone has committed some major crime. It may be loitering, things that you associated with people being homeless or young people being in the street, and people want to clear the streets. So you can be given the choice. And if you're a particularly weak and vulnerable person, they say, well, you can take these drugs, or either we can take you over to D.C. jail, and you're a small frame man or woman, whatever, and it's you don't really have a choice. So it's all associated with sweeping people off the street, getting them, and other maybe family members that really feel distressed because maybe the mental health system is not giving them what they want. Because AOT, as we said, it is not a service. It's just a judicial procedure. There still isn't any more money available to take care of people who may be in emotional distress.
And it costs millions upon hundreds of millions of dollars a year to operate. I wanted to say that I was on the phone with Disability Rights of California today, and we are going to schedule a show with representatives from them to talk about Laura's Law, but also this idea of the black robe effect. And so within the next week or so, we should have that show announced. Because this is a real problem, because the laws are pushing themselves and saying that people don't have to comply with drugs and that the court can't force you to do it, but a judge simply telling you to do it is enough to get people to do it. because of the authority power struggle. But this is a real issue, and if it is so that people do not have to take these drugs, then there should be a massive education campaign to people about that. But of course, then they just, you know, it was like said to me that it's like, you know, plea bargaining. You know, if I take this drug, then I don't have to go to this place. And because these places are so awful, people, you know, are really coerced into complying. And complying with, like, fraud and things that don't necessarily work, and in many cases evidenced as being damaging to us. Jerry, I want to come to you, and then, Eric, I'm going to want to ask you to talk a little bit about the research that you did for Tranquil Prisons.
Absolutely.
Okay, you want me to go first?
Jerry, yes, please.
Okay. Okay, I don't like to be considered as damaged goods. Like, I think I'm normal. There's such a thing as normal. Okay. The psychiatrists think that people who are mentally ill, who are diagnosed with mental illness, I don't think there's such a thing as mental illness, who are diagnosed with mental illness, are different than other people. And that, to me, is eugenics. That's eugenics.
Yeah.
And I know in Canada, we had a somebody who, and it's, if whoever it was that was doing history of the psychiatric movement. In Canada, in the 50s or 60s, there's a guy called Ewan Cameron, who was the first, I think he was the first head of the American Psychiatric Association and the first head of the Canadian Psychiatric Association. He was very strong. And if you have heard of the MK Ultra thing, he was the one that did that one.
I was just going to say this was with the sleep rooms or the and the electric shock and the
whole doses of it. Okay. He in his training was trained by the German psychiatrists, and you know what the German psychiatrists did during the war. The poison gas. They cleared out the mental hospitals. That's the first thing they did, and then they got around to doing the Jews and the gays and everybody else. That's the way the German psychiatrists thought, and people who were trained in. I think Ewan Cameron actually was trained in Germany at one point, but the psychiatric profession followed on from the Germans before the war, and there were people who did that training after the war, and they believe in eugenics, and they say that we are different. We're not different. I don't believe I'm any different than anyone else. And
well,
I don't
agree
like
with you
being
there.
They say that we've got to, our brain is damaged, and we've got to. Our brain chemistry is different, and we've got to alter our brain chemistry, which is a stupid, ridiculous thing, because the brain
is
very complex.
With no proof. I was amazed.
Yeah,
I saw a statistic the other day that almost 50% of the American population believes there's a biological base to these fraudulent psychiatric diagnoses.
I believe it's more than that. I believe it's probably closer to 90%.
But how does, you know, if the pharmaceutical industry is, like, do you guys in Canada don't have direct-to-consumer advertising for the drugs, right?
Yes, we do.
You do?
I've seen Abilify on TV here.
Okay.
We're right on the border, so we get all the ads on TV that you guys have.
Okay.
Like a lot of people in Canada, because they were right on the border, most people likely prefer to watch American television.
Right. So these long historical roots of eugenics, I want to bring back to this because I don't want to just wash over this point because I think it's an important. People need to understand our history and what has historically happened to us and how it's happening to us now. and, you know, with different words being used, but that's all they do is switch the names over. And
yep,
and so
I
you know, and so that these things are still happening to us. And the drugs, for instance, have, like as Yvonne mentioned, different sexual side effects, and often
yeah,
a side effect
like
is
it's torture.
No
what
libido.
The drugs do is and, torture you. Like the psychiatric treatment is torture. Like I point out to people, in the Canadian system, the worst punishment that someone can have in the penal system, like we don't have the death penalty up here, the worst possible punishment that people can have in the penal system is solitary confinement. In the mental health system, the primary treatment is solitary confinement. You get locked up in a rubber room. That's what they do to you.
If we say we're dying, people in the public mental health system, for example, and they say this, like public mental health system, are dying 20 to 25 years, and you're talking about someone who might be 40, you have to realize that their real biological age is 60, because then you're having instances of bone density changes. You're having arthritis. You're having heart conditions, all of these things. And not to have a person to have choice, we know that many people, over half, if they don't take these medications at all, that they get better. It is a small group of people might, you know, benefit over for some medications, but it's still, we, as Pat says, we have inpatient for people who may be dangerous to self or others. But for to have this assisted outpatient treatment for people being in the community, it's a slow death, and it can be very arbitrary. You just get one or more people that say that you're not acting right, and I've seen in Colorado or somewhere else where they mentioned that a police officer, it could be just a police officer's word that could get you into a mental health.
Were your roommates or family members, or, you know, were your spouse? But I think I'm hearing what you're saying about the problems with involuntary, no doubt. But, I mean, institutionalization is a human rights violation in itself, and it goes after
exactly.
Olmstead. It's not in compliance with Olmstead, and it's not, you know, we need community-based alternatives, and one of the main things we need to do is what Pat was talking about before concerning sexual and physical abuse. Like, we need to end these kinds of traumas. And then the other thing that we need to do is really start to appreciate spiritual experiences and creativity and all of these and political thoughts that may not be in line with the culture that you're in, and to stop diagnosing these things too. You know, that it's such a huge problem that people just want to, you know, lock us away. And historically, that's, of course, what they've done, and they continue to do it. This new thing of where we're in institutions without walls, and how it's really an international issue, is adding to it, and yet still taxpayers are paying, you know, billions of dollars a year to fund this, and it's pervasive, much of it is violations of the Convention Against Torture. The United Nations Convention Against Torture, two special rapporteurs have done this, the work of Center for Human Rights of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry and other groups who have been really out there trying to get on international levels to have this addressed. Eric, I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about what's going on in Canada and what you learned from your work.
Thanks, Lauren. There's a lot of examples that Yvonne was using a little earlier that I encountered here too, and it's surprising, you know, how similar these things act, you know, no matter what the name is that they give it, and how many people have had similar experiences. Like, they'll put into your treatment plan something like, you've got to take birth control pills, or you've got to move your apartment because, you know, there's one of your friends is a bad influence, or you'll be expected to do any number of things to comply with your treatment plan. And these things are, you know, it's like the treatment plan is something that in this jurisdiction people have to sign on to. So it's this weird kind of, you know, we're sort of making you do this, but we want your signature on it to make it look like you agreed, right? And this aspect of it, this coercive aspect of it, this looking for agreement, this sort of, you know, pretense at that.
And if you don't agree, we'll lock you up.
That the person is you know, in agreement with it is very, like, central to this kind of procedure, this kind of process. That was something that the work that I was doing kind of ended up finding time and time again, was the contradiction between a psychiatrist asking for your consent and the context of coercion all around you. You know, like as Yvonne was saying, you know, they'll give you choices. They'll say, you know, it's either the cops and the jail and all of that, or it's, you know, this, the shrink and some drugs. What's to be so harmful about these drugs? So people often will choose the latter. And there's a lot of problems with it, obviously, because the drugs aren't safe and effective. As is known now through many studies, they're much less than effective, and they're not very safe in a lot of situations. So people get into all kinds of problems. By then, the drugs have done their work. You know, these drugs are well known to sort of distract people, suppress people in their kind of willfulness. You know, their volition is hacked by major tranquilizers. It's kind of like being on a drug day in and day out. You kind of, you know, something that is kind of fogging up your memory, fogging up your concentration. It's very hard.
Dyskinesia.
Yeah, it's very hard to, you know, it's hard to say no to somebody when you're kind of drugged up. So
with the side effects, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, tardive dyskinesia, metabolic syndrome, all of these different massive,
awful things.
Physical diseases that really can kill us. And of course, that starts to wonder: is this what the goal is?
I was saying I've got a friend who has been on lithium, and right now he's on a what's the machine that they do?
Dialysis.
He's on dialysis, and he's about 10 years younger than I am.
We have so many people,
liver, I think. Is it liver? No, the kidneys, you're right.
He's winning for kidneys.
I think it's from the lithium.
The actual medical issues that these drugs cause are just overwhelming for people, and they're killing us. Like Yvonne said earlier, 25 to 30 years sooner than people who aren't in the public state mental health system diagnosed with a quote-unquote serious mental illness.
The person just one of these drugs. The problem is that they give them multiple things. You're taking two or three medications that affect your kidney and liver. You know, I have talk to people, try to give people information to look up themselves, not to tell them what to do, to look up, and you will see it's obvious. I've gone with people to try to persuade someone to take someone off of something because the medical doctor says if you continue to take this, you're going to lose your kidney functioning, but they have an outpatient order that says that they have to take it, but they're taking some other medication. And that both of them, they affect the kidney. And they said, you continue to take this, in 6 months, you're going to be on kidney dialysis.
Yep.
And that's
my last partner, she died in 2003. She was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And they didn't treat her for a brain tumor. They were treating her for depression.
I'm sorry for your loss. There are so many people, and these are just, you know, little glimpses into the mass amount of people who are affected by this. Eric, in your research, were you looking at how many people and what was the terms and things like that?
Well, there was not a lot of information coming from the government. That was another thing. Just like with ACT, you don't get a lot of statistics. So it was really hard to kind of get a quantitative look at the thing. The government itself admitted that, you know, its lack of good record keeping on it was a problem. They were going to do a review. They ended up doing a review on it, but since that review, nothing else has happened. There haven't been any kind of announcements about, you know, whether they were going to, you know, keep better records and so on. So it's you know, it's a lot of the same problems in terms of just any kind of data that we have on psychiatric interventions. I just wanted to say, just wanted to say a couple of things. You know, just like the coercion issue, how, you know, people will use choice to hide the coercion that's in the system. The other thing they will use are positive narratives from people who will say, you know, I'm really glad I got on the CTO or the IOC because it's giving me a chance to stay out of hospital, or I'm really glad they jumped me and injected me because this, you know, this was a life-saving thing. And I just wanted to say that this is a trick when they point to these narratives and say, see, that means it's good for you. Because, you know, for every one of those stories, there's going to be many, many other stories that show the opposite is true. Why should one person, if somebody likes Coke, why should everybody else be forced to drink Coke? You know, like the two issues, I think, when it comes to CTOs, IOCs, that really bog my mind is how they present it as a choice and how they show these positive stories as proving it's good for everybody. It's unbelievable to me. Anyway, my two cents.
Another big falsehood they use is that, you know, we have all these people that are homeless. I'm going to tell you, if there's a magic pill that many people could take for homeless that would suddenly give them housing and a job, but none of these interventions give housing. None of these interventions, assisted outpatient treatment, does not come with housing, does not come with helping people get a job. You know, there's a lot of myths around why you want to do it. We want to do this because we see these people that are in pain. They don't see them in pain because we saw them really in pain and that we'd have housing for low-income people. We'd help people returning from prison to do so that they wouldn't be stigmatized because they had a prison system sentence. This has been phonied up, this thing about the AOT helping people to get well. There may be anecdotally a person who may have come on their own and wanted to take medication, but the risks are so heavy that how would you leave it up to somebody else to end your life earlier?
Yeah.
Right. I think that these are all really good points. We have somebody calling in from area code 510. Area code 510. Are you there?
Here I am. Yep, I'm here.
Hi. Is this Ted?
Yep, it's Ted.
Hi, Ted.
Your biggest fan, Lauren.
I appreciate you calling in, Ted. That's great. I do want to just get jump over. Pat, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm there.
I'm wondering about this issue of the numbers and how many people are really. Do you want to make any comment about the statistics that they put out?
I was just talking about that today. That they put out numbers like 1 in 4 have mental illness or 1 in 5 have mental illness, and these numbers are all made up because basically it's mental illness is a psychiatrist's opinion. And so this is somebody's opinion. No other medical specialty do we decide what a disease is based on a room full of people getting together and voting on it. And,
who have financial interest in the pharmaceutical companies, right?
Absolutely. But you know, psychiatry is such a huge fraud. I mean, for instance, historically, we didn't have anything such as sadism or masochism. Until psychiatry came along and defined it and said, oh, no, we don't like these things, so therefore we're going to put a label on them and call them whatever. And I mean, you know, people, you know, what people did in their own private bedrooms used to be their business until psychiatry gets involved. Psychiatry really, you know, this is all about control. And, you know, the people who are taking the medications say that they get some relief from the symptoms. I think that they don't understand how toxic the drugs are that they're taking, because if they did, they'd go out to a bar on a Friday night, have a couple of brews with a couple of friends, check out the comedy club, have a few good belly laughs, and be fine.
That sounds
you know?
Like great therapy to me.
Yeah, who needs you know, psychiatric drugs? Somehow they've just sort of been brainwashed into accepting that they need to pop these pills in order for their lives to somehow be okay. And a lot of what I do, I think, you know, we've all been raised from infancy to trust doctor. Doctor will fix it. So we've been raised from the time we first went to walking on 2 feet. We've been taught, if you have something wrong, go see doctor. Trust doctor. Doctor. So when we have
and
wrong,
even though the commercials tell you at the end, they give you the disclaimer. They say,
when we have something wrong with our emotions, we go see doctor. We trust doctor. We want doctor to fix it. They don't have any fixes. Instead of relying on our own, you know, good sense, we put our lives in the hands of these people. If I thought I had something wrong with my brain, I would go see an expert on the brain. I would talk to a neurologist. And if my emotions are out of kilter, I could talk to family, friends, you know, if I'm hard-pressed, talk to clergy or even a psychologist. But where does that leave psychiatry as anything except shills for big pharma?
Yeah, and I think when you look at the amount of money that's being paid, especially the taxpayer dollars, billions of dollars a year, trillions of dollars over time, or more, that people are just so ill-informed about the reality of what it is they're participating in. Ted, I want to bring you in, and then I want to ask Eric another question about the money and what people are actually getting when they're under the community treatment orders in Canada. So, Ted, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I just tuned in, but I did hear a discussion of where does this 1 out of 4 come from, and that was discussed earlier today online on the website to address the Murphyville, and some guy from I think he's from the Bazelon Center, which is a pretty good source of stuff. He found some academic paper where all of this figure is supposed to come from, and the summary of it is: mental health authorities agree that about 1/4 of people are mentally ill. Now, what does that mean, mental health authorities agree? It means we say so, and so it's true. I mean, that's the most nonsensical thing. Well, hey, psychiatric survivors agree that psychiatry is total crap, right? And that's just as expert as what they say. I mean, actually, we have a lot more experience. We're the ones that experience it, so our word ought to be law here, you know. But anyway, that 1/4 figure comes because in this fancy paper, they basically said mental health authorities agree that it's about 1/4. It's just such total nonsense.
They make it up. I would tend to look more at what the CDC says, and their statistics are nowhere near that high. But I wanted to point out, because, Lauren, you did point out that African American and other minorities are disproportionately will come
targeted
under AOT. But there's a new illness now they've made up. They call it, I don't know if you, have you heard of Hood disease? They
of what?
Say now
what?
In Hood disease. Hood, H-O-O-D. They say that
Hood.
Now they have another, they don't say, I like post-traumatic injury, but they have a new disease called Hood disease, and they say in urban areas, 30% of minorities have this Hood disease. So this is a new illness that's been made up. So I think it's just like when you say 1 in 4, these are things that are made up. And what happens, people think because they see it and what they think is a respected newspaper and it gets repeated, that's true. But it's not.
I'd like to hear more about this hood disease. How do you get it? Do you wear a hood? Is that the idea? Because I'm in big trouble then.
It's about trauma, and if you go to that same page that you saw that discussion on 1 in 4, I'll put it, I'll transfer it up there. But, yes, that's what it is. And their answer to helping people with trauma, of course, is the same thing. It's a chemical thing.
Not something new. We came up with that in the 1970s, and they said that blacks who rioted in the 1970s were deemed to have protest psychosis. And some were not even need brain surgery.
Yeah, right. And Metzl, and Jonathan Metzl's work is really amazing on the protest psychosis and showing how African Americans are misdiagnosed at alarming rates. So I'm just looking at this article called Hood Disease. Harvard doctors say inner city youth suffer from PTSD. Give it a discriminative name. And this is on the website Global Grind. And so the first line is, a new report from the Center for Disease Control is suggesting inner-city kids suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, a health problem Harvard doctors have coined hood disease. And so how horrifying and discriminatory is that? This is just, thanks for alerting me to this, Yvonne. This is just awful.
Mm-hmm.
Awful, and of course there is the daily stress and discrimination that people experience, and what Geronimus and Thompson called the weathering model of how this slowly breaks down from daily repetitive abuse. But how and this is just the arrogance of psychiatry and like the arrogance of the way for example. Murphy treated people during the hearings about H.R. 3717 the Mental Health Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act, the Murphy Bill.
Do you have an example of what he did, Lauren?
Well, at one point he had asked, I'm blanking on the guy's name from SAMHSA, if he knew what the term anosognosia is. When the man reported that he had heard of it, Murphy turned around and said something like, "Well, that's very disappointing. Now it's time for me to give you a lesson." Nancy Jensen was speaking, just the level of arrogance that he asked her about whether she had read the bill, and when she said yes, he went back in and said the whole bill. Like, just the most disrespectful, and when she tried to speak at one point, he cut her off, and it this idea that they have this answer that is based in absolute fraud. They just absolutely do not have the evidence that they're suggesting that they have. And the fact that they're able to go after us in these ways is just people, to really, for the public to start understanding that it can be anyone and it can be them that this happens to. It is not this mysterious other group of this type of person that exists, but that this person comes in and that there is an intentional destruction of that person to change them into a mental patient, and that what people see are people who are drugged and who have been emotionally just raped and had their hopes and dreams taken away from them and told that they're not allowed to work or forced to be in program, preventing them from working, creating jobs for these, quote-unquote mental health professionals. And there are good mental health professionals. I don't want to say it sound like there's not, on an individual level, but on a systemic basis, this is a monstrous problem. Eric, from a perspective of finance versus what it is people are getting, were you able to
dig up any kind of information around that?
Well, our mental health system in Ontario is constantly being redrawn and quartered and redone. And, you know, the way that they're spending from year to year is not very consistent. I can't really, you know, give you many details in terms of millions of dollars spent on what kinds of services, but one thing is for sure, even as certain changes happen, for example, moving from, you know, a ministerial sort of governmental model of fiscal control over to a more, you know, sort of a board of governors kind of model of, you know, looking after business, there's still a continued obsession, I guess, with controlling for danger amongst the mad. You know, there's always this, you know, the worst case scenario. What if somebody comes at me with a knife? You know, that drives the system. And so, you know, even though mental health dollars have been pulled out of hospitals to the point where now we have very few of the same, you know, programs that we used to have, fewer wards and such. You would have thought that would be a good thing, but of course, they didn't actually spend that money on any of the other more preventative programs that were suggested to them throughout the era of deinstitutionalization, which of course never really happened. So the money doesn't get spent on the preventative stuff. It continues to get spent on the, hammer it down stuff, right? Get them into treatment, early interventions for younger people. And so the actual services that people are getting are sort of like they used to be, but they're not quite as well financed. So some of the money might be put into treatment teams, assertive community treatment teams. And that means that, you know, there might be one team that, you know, in many situations, they might get something like $1 million for that team. Most of it is eaten up by the doctors and the nurses, some of it by social workers, and then a very small amount maybe by a peer worker who they've managed to get on board, who does most of the grunt work for them, right? And will try even to encourage people to be on medications and whatnot. But in terms of the services that people are getting, they're not getting the supports that they need. They might be getting it from peer support workers here and there, but that's a very sketchy project, and it's still not being implemented everywhere. They are certainly not getting that kind of support from the people who are wielding the letters after their names. And so you've got, there were several, in my research, there were several stories that people were saying, you know, the CTO was supposed to provide somebody with this, 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 and this, but instead what ended up happening was that the family had to provide those things for them, or an alternative agency would have to provide those things for them. And for some people, the most damning thing was that if they wanted to get off of CTO, they had to prove to the tribunal, what they call here the Consent and Capacity Board, that they were going to get these services in the community to support them and to keep them from getting in trouble so that they'd have to be drugged. So here's this person, you know, arguing with the board saying, look, I can find all these alternatives. I can find a bit here from my family over there, from this agency over here. But, and so, you know, you don't have to put me on a CTO. And, you know, the Consent and Capacity Board would say, well, okay, fine, we'll let you go. And, I found maybe one out of 25 cases in which the person was allowed to go that way. But it meant that basically they had to scrounge up the services that the system was supposed to be giving that person themselves, right? So this is the problem with the kinds of services being offered, is that they're slipshod at best, and most of it is about trying to control for any dangers that might happen.
Right, that's why most of the data on AOT has to do with criminal justice, doesn't have to do with people getting better. If you look at that, it's that, and mostly you mentioned acting. I just want to say very quickly that even, I hate to quote this source, but E. Philip Torrey says that 25%, only 25% of ACT teams in the country really act like ACT teams. So even the medical model services that they claim they have are not available, even if the person is in AOT, they're not going to get the service.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so, Eric, you call what's happening to people chemical incarceration, right? And so
yeah.
what are you seeing that caused that kind of...
Just as Yvonne was saying, it's more about, you know, it's really about control rather than care. And it's that's the reason I kind of went and I wrote this stuff, like I wrote up the data that I had on based on criminology, because what I started to recognize was that it was drug to restrain first and then see if you can, you know, and then use the drug as a treatment second or later, right? Like shoot first, ask questions later. It really is a system in which restraint is the primary motive, and then care and, you know, support might be after effects, you know, that they, you know, obviously they hope for, but they're not necessary to the
ketchup on the hamburger.
What's that, sorry? It's
just the ketchup on the hamburger.
Yeah.
Just the condiment.
Yvonne.
Exactly. Just get that ketchup on there, it'll be fine. But that's the thing is the way that the whole thing is framed by professionals is it's all about therapy, it's all about treatment, we're trying to give people the treatment they need, we're trying to be kind to them, but, you know, sometimes they break the boundaries and they come at us and that's where we have to bring in, you know, the ugly side of the system. But it's kind of like it's the opposite way around, is that the system comes at people all, you know, all about, you know, either ors and, you know, if this, then that, you know, the only reason we're drugging you is because you might be a danger to yourself or others. You might suffer deterioration. So they predicate such incredible controls based on therapy. And so the book is about trying to shift our thinking from looking at psychiatry as a treatment kind of mode or you know, a therapeutic kind of industry, to looking at it more readily as what it is, which is restraint, constraint. You know, it's a punitive industry. At least at the bottom line, if things get bad, you know that psychiatry is going to have the power to detain, to isolate, to restrain, and then deliver brain-damaging treatments, basically, right? And I'm not, you know, I know that there are people who will say, well, no, these treatments don't damage my brain. They actually made my brain think a lot straighter. You know, but then I have to ask, you know, well, are we looking at the scientific data? Because it's saying quite the opposite. When you look at something like the Katie trial, you're seeing 75% of people are not are ditching the drugs after, you know, several months because they don't work or because they're harmful. So all the anecdotes that we have that say that the drugs do the trick, I'm not doubting that. But at the same time, I don't think that they're representative. And that's the problem, is that this stuff is being poured on people as though it's safe and effective for everybody, and it isn't, you know. So anyway, as I'm trying to say, the chemical incarceration piece comes from the idea that the drugs are used as a restraint primarily, and then it gets into a little bit more detailed study of how they do that and looks at Whitaker and some of his research and Bregan, and, you know, you can see how the brain is affected by these drugs, how motivations are decreased, how they're constrained, how people are kept from thinking straight so that they can't answer certain questions. They don't really have that volition that they used to. And, you know, the question then becomes for me, when we're looking at psychiatry as a treatment industry, we're missing a huge part of the equation. And I think it's the denominator, the bigger part of the equation. And that is how it controls the body, how it controls the mind, how it controls people's agency in society, and therefore how it controls the way that we get together and talk about how to take care of each other and how to make sure our society isn't unfair and how to actually give people voice or give each other voice, you know, in a common group meeting and so on. So this is the question for me is, how do CTOs and IOCs and AOTs, how do they show us exactly how that works? Well, you know, somebody is offering you a treatment, they're saying it's your choice, but they're saying, but we'll make it into an order or we'll make it mandatory so that you don't forget. It's like, what kind of treatment is that? If your treatment works, you shouldn't have to worry about, you know, anything going badly. You know, you would expect that a treatment that works would prevent somebody from skipping their treatment or hallucinating and then dropping their treatment or whatever it is, forgetting their treatment. You would think that the treatment would actually focus the mind, but of course it's just a trap.
Oh, by the way, you might just gain 100 pounds. You might have crippling arthritis. You know, you might have hypertension and heart disease. You know,
diabetes too, Yvonne.
Yeah, I mean, you know,
and that,
I mean,
that includes if you're. Well, that just includes if you're taking it voluntarily or involuntarily. It all applies. Even people sometimes think that if it's people are voluntarily taking it, that they somehow escape these things, but they don't.
Oh,
and then
okay.
And then when they realize that it does apply to them too, it's often unfortunately too late.
I'd like to raise some legal issue here that's very relevant to the phrase that Eric used, chemical incarceration, and I hope that I can explain this in 3 minutes because legal explanations can be pretty terrible. You know, the Murphy
Ted,
bill is
like
going
to
basically – yeah?
Oh, I would just like to say, would you like to let people know about your training in this?
Yeah, I'm a lawyer. And
thanks.
I've done a lot of patients' rights work in California. And the Murphy bill, which I assume you've been talking about, we have a Supreme Court decision from 1975 called the Donaldson case, which overruled the idea that people could be locked up on the basis of so-called need for treatment and says you can only be held if you're a danger to yourself or others or what we call in California gravely disabled, not able to take care of yourself. Now, the Murphy bill is going to force the states to have a very different standard, which comes right down to need for treatment, okay, which violates what the Supreme Court unanimously ruled in 1975. Now, here's a little tricky legal thing. I hope I can explain it simply. The argument is going to be, in law, we talk about distinguishing a situation, and what they're going to say is it doesn't violate the Donaldson case, because it's different. The Donaldson case was only talking about locking people up. But we're only talking about treating them in the community with drugs, of course. So it's very important to develop this idea that drugging people is just as much a violation of their liberty as locking them in a state hospital is, because a whole legal argument is going to revolve around that, because they're going to claim it's what lawyers would call lesser deprivation of liberty, but it isn't. I mean, I think your phrase chemical incarceration is wonderful. It summarizes the whole thing here. And then, of course, all the other stuff that Yvonne and I'm sure everybody who's spoken talks about the terrible things these drugs do to people. But I think it's really important for our movement, and you know, I'm hearing it now, for our movement to establish that it's just as bad to force drugs on people as it is to lock them on a ward. In fact, I'd rather be locked on a ward and not drugged than be out in the community and have drugs forced on me. I mean, I spent 15 years locked up, and so, no, 11 years, I'm sorry. I spent 11 years locked up as a child, but, you know, they didn't drug me, and that's why I survived. If I'd been given drugs all through my childhood, I wouldn't be talking to you now. I'd be gone long ago. So again, I think it's real important to establish that idea that drugging people in the community is just as much a violation of their liberty, because for sure if this bill passes, we're going to have to do a full court press with legal arguments. It's going to have to go to the Supreme Court, because on the face of it, it violates what the Supreme Court decided unanimously. How many years ago was that? 39 years ago in the Donaldson case.
I'd like to come back to this in a second. I just want to break in 1 second. If you're out there listening and you want to call in, you have something to say, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Yvonne, sorry, can you continue?
Yeah, and I think this is not going to just be adults. Could be children,
right?
You know, and might decide they don't want their child to take an ADHD medication. You know, maybe, you know, especially I'm just saying this because of my community, African American boys, other people, you know, things that we think of being normal teenage activity or just part of being a teenager, you may be subject to school and other places saying, well, you know, we need to have this child medicated in order for them to have a presence in the school. And so you have very young people, you know, maybe 5, 6 years old, may be subject to have medication just so that they can attend school. So this is very dangerous, very dangerous. And if anybody has thinks it's not, they should, and someone look at the history of what happened in Nazi Germany. What they did was legal. You know, at Nuremberg trials, people said they were following the law. So we may have the same thing. It may not happen instantaneously, you know, as soon as, but it's a very strong danger that you will not be able to make decisions about your own child.
That's right, and people are losing custody of their children because they're not wanting to comply and they're being charged with medical neglect.
They kidnapped her from Connecticut to Massachusetts.
Right, Justina. Justina.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is
bad.
This is Pat. I'd like to jump in when I get a chance, please.
Okay, Pat.
Yeah. I want to, you know, we're talking about this Murphy legislation, and I want to be clear that it's not about treatment at all. Ivana's right. It's about control and scapegoating. Scapegoating is blaming a particular group. And historically, yeah, World War II, you know, the Nazis like to blame the Jews. But in this instance, we're scapegoating people that psychiatry labels as mentally ill. And the whole thing is they're talking about how the mentally ill need this control because we're the ones going out pulling the triggers and shooting school kids and other kinds of things. That's not
but
the
all
fact.
Of those people were under
that's
treatment.
The fact
all
is,
those people that killed school were under treatment. They were taking the chemicals.
Okay, and
the chemicals are deeply linked. I think that social control, psychiatry as social control, I think is something that, again, we need to be educating the public about and getting a message that is not fueled by the, you know, huge profit of the pharmaceutical industry to the people. And to get to people resources if they are being forced to drug their children and things like the Psych Rights Medicaid Fraud Initiative for children who are being given off-label drugs because that's illegal, which people can find at psychrights.org, and other attempts that are being made in order to have young people not go through this and supports for their family members who may be also. And of course, I mean, I'm not sure what the laws are all over the country, but in New York State, it goes both ways because if you have a psychiatric history, they can take your child away from you for no cause outside of the fact that you have a psychiatric history, any psychiatric history, depression, anxiety, anything. And so, you know,
that's
we need to get back
people
to...
Away.
Well, I want to finish my thought, though, that people who get labeled mentally ill aren't the only ones who are dangerous to self or others. I mean, there are obese people who drive through McDonald's. There are people who smoke cigarettes and forget to take their inhaler. There are people who have diabetes who go out and buy an ice cream cone. And it's not people labeled as mentally ill who are dangerous. The ones who've done most of the shootings, just as a point of fact, have been young white males. So we ought to be locking up all the young white males if that's the case. But because Murphy gets all of his crap from E. Fuller Torrey, who believes that schizophrenia comes from kitty poop, maybe we ought to be locking up all the cats. But my point is,
you're saying that kitty poop
All of this violence is coming from anger, not what gets labeled as mental illness. And anger comes from abuse and powerlessness, such as that which AOT would create. AOT creates powerlessness. It is an abuse of power, and it's going to generate more anger, and I believe it's going to generate more people who want to take a gun and go out and blow people away. And we need to be helping people, not with mental illness. We need to be helping people with anger and emotions, their feelings. If you're angry because you were hurt, let's help people deal with that. Let's not be, you know, slapping labels on them and locking them up. And if treatment were effective, desirable, and actually worked, then everybody would be clamoring for treatment. But I also wanted to agree with Ted, locking up the body versus using drugs to lock up the mind, they claim is least restrictive. I think it's much more restrictive to lock up my mind. And a final point, you look up Wikipedia, go look at Rebecca Riley. This is a young girl, age 2, diagnosed bipolar. She was found dead in her home at age 4 with her lungs and heart badly damaged from exposure to all of the psychiatric drugs. Mom and dad are in prison. The psychiatrist who labeled and prescribed those drugs labeled this young girl. The psychiatrist is still in business. There is something.
Yeah,
really
I understand. Was given immunity for their testimony against the parents.
There is something seriously, seriously wrong in our society, and you know. So if you hear some anger in my voice, that's what it's about.
Yeah. And there are so many people who are being exposed to us. And I think one of the points that Ted makes often is that there are tens of millions of us, and that people who may be listening or, you know, who may not know about this, to understand that there are people out there who have gone through it and gotten out, and that it is possible, and that there are alternatives that people can utilize in order to support themselves. I think the interesting thing about the Donaldson case is that that's the basis of Saz's 1977, I think, book, Psychiatric Slavery, where he begins to outline how what we're experiencing is a form of slavery. And I think it is. And I think that when people are... What Iman was saying earlier about people are not allowed to go get jobs. They have to, their job is to create a job for a mental health worker who has to, you know, be with them all day. That is putting us in a position of where our life, liberty, and fortune is under the control of another, and that is
the definition of
slavery. And so, you know, people don't want to see it this way because they're brainwashed by the advertising of the pharmaceutical industry and the psychiatric industry about, you know, keeping their profession alive and moving. But it really is devastating to our many people's bodies and lives.
And still no test.
Anybody who's not familiar with this stuff, please go to Wikipedia and look at Rebecca Riley and tell me
I've seen that story before, and I just cry. I just imagine people that what they do is, and this was a family that was unemployed, and they were relying on Social Security benefits. And, you know, they went to educated, degreed doctors who gave them this advice, and they followed that. They followed the advice. They gave the drug at the instruction of a doctor. And the doctor then turns around, gets immunity for testifying against the parents. I mean, this is really, really very sad.
It's criminal.
For those people out there who might think that somehow treatment is an okay thing and they might be in favor of it, here's one of the results of treatment.
No child aged 2 years old needs to be taking these medications. I've seen this at the time. I was taking medications at 6 years old. But no child 2 years old, barely out of the nursery, needs to be taking medication like that. That we know, and this person, child was taking Seroquel. And you know how dangerous that drug is for a two-year-old brain. Now, they tell you that don't smoke marijuana because this stuff is going to affect your brain up until you're age 25. So you're going to give a two-year-old child who's still developing hard drugs. And then what they're saying is we want to prevent schizophrenia. And looking at the things that have been working for preventing emotional distress, it doesn't have anything to do with these strong chemicals. It has to do with social isolation, supports for the family, anti-bullying, other things. None of this stuff about giving a two-year-old, a small child, these very toxic drugs. You might as well take Drano and put it and pour it on them.
Mm-hmm.
It is horrifying. And before a child is even able to, like, you know, have a thought of their own and express it, like, that how they could be assigning these diagnoses to these children like this that are all based in fraud. Again, there is no blood test. There is no brain scan. There is no scientific evidence of any of this existing. There's plenty of scientific evidence about the damage that it does. Why they have no proof and they're believed, and we have evidence of damage, and we're not believed is beyond me, and that's where it gets into this larger.
And Lauren, the mother,
I'm sorry to bring this
life
up,
in prison.
I don't trust that what DJ Jaffe is listening in right now, and if he is, I sure hope he gets this message because. Someday, he's going to be held accountable. He and Aoife Lortori and the rest of them. There will come a time of reckoning, I believe.
I think that the message that they are putting out, which is so fraudulent, is really complicit in creating massive crimes against humanity. And I think that the more people that buy into what it is that they're offering, the quicker we're going to be in a more perilous, dangerous situation. In the early 20th century, when they said it was an infectious disease, Tori and Jochen put out an article in 2010 about the Nazi genocide of us. And described in detail the fake, quote-unquote, bathroom showers that the mental patients were marched into and then gassed. And at the end of that article, they suggest that it might be, you know, that there may be some infection of some sort, going back to their, you know, cat feces theory of toxoplasma Gandhi. In the early 20th century, they were taking out our teeth and our tonsils and our innards and in search of some focal sepsis, so some monster infection that was going through us, and hundreds of people were dying. And Andrew Scull's work on Madhouse, everybody should read, because it really shows the organization of organized psychiatry and how it is that it perpetuates itself. And so whether, part of the...
Can you explain? I don't want to interrupt you, but it's sometime if we have enough time for people who may be new to this. Can you, somebody, explain this cat poo theory about schizophrenia? I mean, just in a little short time, if you have time later.
I think we can go into it in depth another time, but briefly, and Pat, correct me, or anybody correct me if I've missed anything, but I believe that there was some amount of people who had been diagnosed with schizophrenia whose mothers had, while pregnant, handled cat feces, and that the toxic plasmi gondii, I'm saying that wrong, was transmitted somehow to the fetus and caused the infection, which in later life, after laying dormant for however many years, turns into schizophrenia. Eric, anyway.
Yeah,
look up and cat feces.
And I believe the article was published in, I believe it was published in 2003, and it's Tori and Yolken, Y-O-L-K-E-N. And so they also wound up doing this Nazi genocide article where they were looking to see if the rate of schizophrenia dropped after World War II, which is just a horrifying thing that really needs to be addressed. That would even be what they were searching out for. And so there is this call from people in society who want to find some kind of genetic biological link to begin to exterminate us and prevent us from being born, which they'll never find. They've been looking for it for centuries. It's just, and I think that these issues that everybody's brought up about trauma and the environment and economics and discrimination and all kinds of other, challenges of living in capitalistic environments, that they are largely being ignored by psychiatry, and much of psychology, unfortunately, has this bizarre allegiance to psychiatry. And I can't understand why, because psychologists can't offer what psychiatry offers, with the exception of those who are rallying to be able to get prescribing power. That's another whole debate, too, but the issue of the long historical systemic violation and how it was organized in order to exterminate us, I think, as many people have said in different ways tonight, has not gone.
People better wake up before it's too late.
Eyes wide open.
It's expanding. There's no doubt about it. I mean, there's work out there now. By Waters, I forget his first name, Ethan Waters, I believe it is, talking about how we're exporting this medical model to, all over the world. I mean, more and more, disaster survivors are being medicated or, they're being indoctrinated into this way of looking at things, that basically any emotion you show at whatever happens around you is probably the indication that you have a weak neurological system, that basically other people could handle it, or, obviously they've handled it differently than you have. If you start crying, if you start freaking out, you've got a mental illness, right? So this system is becoming more and more widespread. Last May, I had the privilege of being with the World Network of Users and Survivors of Psychiatry out in Cape Town, and I was hearing from people who were complaining that in rural Kenya there was drugging going on very much in the same way that there are in general hospitals here in Toronto. And I was just floored by this. I was just like, how did it get so far that they're pulling people in from the countryside? They're, wherever they can make their cash, they're making it, right? And there are people fighting this now from all over the world. Yeah.
That's all it is. They're just new. They're just new customers, because a lot of these places, if you World Health Organization stuff, you'll see people recover in a lot of these places where they haven't had these drugs and medications. Now you'll see that the rates of different mental health diagnoses start jumping off the radar screen. And the only thing that you can see is now that they have access to all these medications. They're just a new customer.
Yeah, new customers. I just want to cut in for 1 second right here. Caller from 818, are you there?
I am. Hi, how are you?
Hi, who's calling?
Hi, this is Tammy calling from the National Safe Child Coalition. I'm really appreciative of your show.
Thanks, Tammy.
This is a great
topic. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'd love to hear more about Murphy, the Murphy bill, and if there is a number and the attorney's name. I didn't get that.
Okay, so I'm going to hold off on explaining more about the Murphy bill. I'm going to give you the number for it. It's HR 3717.
Thank you, 3717.
And I'm going to see, is there anybody on the call who would like to talk specifically about what the Murphy bill is about and what?
There is a Facebook page that she can go to.
That'd be great.
I think if you search on Facebook, Stop the Murphy Bill.
Ma'am, the attorney you wanted, is that the attorney who's on the call now?
Yes, please.
His name is Ted. He's here.
Yeah, well, I don't know if I have a great deal of expertise on the Murphy Bill. I just know that one issue that, to me, the most frightening part of it is the way it's lowering the standard for commitment, making it much easier for the psychiatrist to grab you. I don't know if you heard that earlier discussion where I was talking about what we need. I know what the legal arguments are going to be when it's challenged in court. It's very clear to me. But this isn't giving you an overall picture, and I'm not quite sure where to refer you because I wouldn't call myself really an expert on it. Lauren, you must know somebody that really knows a lot about it.
I can give an overview, but it does several things that are very problematic, and I'm not doing these in any particular order. But the most important is this expansion of involuntary outpatient commitment laws, and how states are going to be coerced through financial incentives to develop involuntary outpatient commitment laws to maintain their Medicaid funding for institutions. And then it also wipes out PAMI, which is the Protection and Advocacy for Individuals with Mental Illness. It wipes out a lot of SAMHSA's funded alternatives, but also things like the Minority Research Fellowship and other opportunities for people who have been in oppressed situations to make their way through, and grants and things like that. To me, one of the most horrifying things is that it accuses SAMHSA and national organizations of being anti-psychiatry, which is, I said before and will say again, ludicrous. But I think it's really this expansion of the involuntary outpatient commitment laws that have many of us very concerned.
But there
right.
is
something
another,
that we've taken notice
bill
of.
Also, that is not draconian. That's the H.R. 4574, and you should look at that if you H.R. 4574. And so we're hopeful that there will be some coming together, and that those, especially the things on AOT and the PNA, we just have to hope that they go away, because we're really looking at a 1930s scenario if that passes.
What do you think that any, and this question is for any one of you, what do you think that the driving force is? Is it financial incentives? Is that the driving force that is giving children psychotropic drugs and forcing people to go into facilities and forcing these drugs on these people and, in many instances, causing them to go over the edge?
I think one of the other persons said that it's anger. We don't know what goes into forcing people to doing stuff is the drugs itself. Many of these drugs that they prescribe actually cause suicidal and homicidal feelings. I mean, a lot
right.
of the
I understand.
Doers,
I understand that component, but why?
A lot of the shooters.
Why
actually,
are they issuing? Why are they prescribing these very strong? Like you said a little while ago, I believe it was you that said a 2-year-old was prescribed Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic.
For the big, for the large pharmaceutical companies, We're talking about a multi-billion dollar a year business. And as the adults are starting to die over 25 years younger than the general population, they needed to find new markets. The new markets that they're developing are children and in the third world and other countries. So
they take the funds.
You know, they're trying to continue to make big bucks for their company.
They think
right. An area that we're finding that is so disturbing is the foster care. Foster care children, there's such a financial incentive. If a foster child is brought in by the state, so many of them, and this number is growing horrifically, are suddenly diagnosed with a disorder or a syndrome causing them to then be put on these psychotropic drugs, and they are very young. And then the financial incentive is increased because now they have what is considered a special needs child. Even though many of these children were never diagnosed before going into this temporary or possibly permanent care.
A few years ago, Eli Lilly was the subject of a lawsuit, and in this lawsuit against Eli Lilly, they exchanged memos that were exchanged between the board of directors and the CEO of Eli Lilly, where the board of directors sat around and they had discussions about, quote, acceptable losses. They knew that these medications would kill people, and they had the gall to sit around and talk about, well, gee, okay, so if we do kill some people, is it okay, you know, can we afford to pay a few people off? Or is it going to be larger numbers that we can't afford to pay off? That's how
and the times aren't big enough. They've had the Department of Justice, rightly so, has fined or come to agreement where the company where the companies have clawed back money, but they don't go to the people who are the victims of this. They usually go back to the states for Medicaid. But it's all financially driven, and they calculate. I'm quite sure, just as you said, you know, they can absorb a $1 billion fine because the market is so great. I don't know if you ever saw this new movie where Charlton Heston, where people say it's Soylent Green. Well, there is not going to be a place where it's almost like you look at the DSM-5. Almost anyone could have a diagnosis. And the only purpose of these things is to give guidance to the physicians so they can prescribe more of these toxic medications. You should ask the psychiatrist, do any of them take these medications, and or do they allow any of their family members to take it? And most of the time, when you ask that question, you'll find out they'll say, hell no.
Right.
It's
and I think, isn't there a financial incentive for the physician who prescribes?
Yeah, in many states, there have been laws put in, Tammy, in order to stop that from happening, for any kind of financial kickbacks for physicians or but now they go through, since they can't go directly to the physicians, now they go to the secretaries and administrative support people and give them the lunches and things like that in order to try to boost sales of certain products. But I want to touch on what you said about foster care because I think it's urgently important. Young people in foster care are being overly drugged and put into the system. The financial incentives are huge, and when the parent is when your parent is the quote unquote state, there are multiple avenues in which this power can be abused. And one of the ways it's abused is by putting the rate of children who are in who become, quote-unquote, subjects in scientific research, medical research, and that there are these pipelines that we've found evidence dating back to the 1940s between certain foster care agencies and certain city and state institutions and educational institutions where they're using these kids in foster care, who are already on some level or another are trauma survivors,
And so instead of addressing the loss, whatever losses they've experienced that caused them to wind up in foster care or being ripped away from their families for whatever, you know, often arbitrary, subjective, values, culture-based kinds of issues that they're being ripped away from their families for, it further complicates it, and we really need to be, I think one night we're going to do a special just on children in foster care and bring people who have lived through the foster care system in to talk about their experiences. And but the financial incentives are just gross.
Yeah, I just want to throw in that it also consolidates their interests in a lot of ways to make their drugs marketable to children or to other communities that traditionally might have used, you know, indigenous knowledges for dealing with, issues in terms of emotions and so on, in terms of people's disputes. It's in their interests to expand the market so that it's like, you know, in every situation they can always say, psychiatry can help, and in fact, psychiatry has the correct answer to what's wrong. It's a brain thing, and to find it in children, you know, like this speaks volumes to say that a three-year-old is exhibiting behaviors that are indicative of psychosis rather than just a free imagination and a free heart is just tells you how far the encroachment has gone. And this is good for business in the sense of not only having more customers, but showing all customers that basically this is a universal science. This science goes everywhere. It is in every culture. It is in every household. So that contains and restricts the critique, that might say, well, in our culture, we don't have those kinds of things, or, well, in our house, we consider this to be imagination when a person hears voices. You know, those things are out the window the more the industry targets youth and people who don't live in, say, countries like North America or continents like North America.
Wow. You know, there is what is it, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. I don't know if anybody's familiar with that from 1975.
Yes.
These schools, even our educational facilities, they receive about $400 per child if they are diagnosed with ADHD.
What an incentive.
$400. I'm sorry?
I said, what an incentive. You know?
Right. Well, you know, you've got a school with, you know, 1,000 children, 500 children, whatever it is, that's like a bonus to them. And there are schools that have actually told the parents because the child was talking too much. If we can even imagine that 30 years ago, a talkative child we labeled as brilliant and outgoing and an extrovert, and now we have taken that away and we are labeling them with these disorders and silencing them.
And we really are. And 60 years ago, the part of the diagnosis of childhood schizophrenia was that it was a child who had extremely high intelligence, great verbal skills, caused countertransference in adults. These children that we are just mutilating are great suffering greatly for it. Tammy, I'm wondering, what organization again did you say you were with?
I'm with the National Safe Child Coalition.
And what kind of numbers do you see?
As far as
children? What's happening with children with psychiatry, are there any particularly startling things that you're seeing?
I would be happy if you have an email. I'd be happy to provide you with some of the research that we have come across, which is just so powerful to present I'd be more than happy. I think it's too detailed and probably too confusing for the show, and to start citing the sources and to break everything down. But I'd love to pass that information along. I think you're doing a great job.
Thanks. That would be great. And maybe one night we can schedule something specifically where you come and talk about that and other issues, and have callers, calling in about their own experiences. But if you could, like, sum it up in a sentence without, like, actually citing anything or anything, like, if you can say, like, this is my perspective on where the system is now.
Okay. So just to let you know, I'm sorry, what is your name?
My name is Lauren Tenney. And my email is laurentenney@aol.com.
Thank you so much, Lauren. So I have a blog radio show as well, and I touch on a lot of these issues, but not in this manner, which is, I'm so grateful that you are, because I'd love to pass this information again along to you. If I could sum it up in a nutshell, we had some cases that came to us where one case, for example, a 7-year-old boy who was originally from Africa. So if we can imagine the culture there and the tradition and the daily activities are quite different than here in America. And this child came 7 years old. And he, after being in his elementary school for a month or so, was labeled as psychotic, because he didn't want to do some of the things that the typical American child was taught to do. His father was away. He was out of the country, and mom was here. Here being, actually, this case was out of Las Vegas. They took this child away from the mom. Mom had no idea. CPS came in, took the child away, and put him in a lockdown prison-type facility. Dad worked for the government undercover, quite honestly, and Dad finally was able to be released from his duties and came back. The dad has provided us with some photographs that he covertly took of this small room that was no different than a maximum facility that we would find a prison system, a murderer perhaps. This child had bruising all over the back of him them putting their knees in his back and holding him down. Why were they holding him down? Well, we came to understand what his parents did. He had been given in every day 7 different psychotropic drugs that were so powerful. He's very lucky to have lived through it. As a result, of course, he lost his mind and he flipped out, thus justifying them being able to restrain him in the manner that they did. The facility that the state mandated through CPS charged about a little less than $1 million per child per year. $1 million. So if this is not enough of a driving force, just knowing about this one child, just seeing this facility, it's beyond horrific. We're always advocating for people to become very proactive. So whatever assistance or in whichever way we might assist you, any of you that are on today, to help get this message out, to share information, to get out studies that are being done or bills or laws that are being vetoed or passed, or we want them to go forward, we'd be happy to. We have a Facebook account, National Safe Child Coalition, and any help, and I'll be sure to email you, Lauren. Thank you so much.
Great.
For all of you.
Tabby,
for letting
thank,
me,
thank you,
up.
And I look forward to learning more about the work that you're doing, and you know, what you shared is just horrific, and I think will be eye-opening to many people. And I appreciate you taking the time, and so I look forward to being in touch and working more.
I appreciate you allowing me so much time. You, You all, thank you so much.
Is this National Safe Child or Safe Child?
This is National Safe Child. I'm going to send it over to Lauren. I'm going to send my information over to her.
And I'll make sure to get it out.
Is there a chat room online with your show, Lauren?
There is a chat room, and also on the Blog Talk Radio / Talk with Tenny. And you can post things there also. You know, I'll be sure to post it, and hopefully that Tammy will be in touch.
Absolutely.
We only have a few minutes left. Absolutely. So I just want to really thank everybody for being on the call tonight and working through these really important issues that we're facing as a society, and that you know, that anyone is at risk of being subjected to massive human rights violations, as we've clearly talked about tonight, including loss of life, torture, and slavery. I think that you know, there are some events that are coming up, including the 34th annual Bastille Day demonstration and celebration in Albany, New York, and the Mind Freedom Conference in Connecticut, and the Esmond Green Vigil in Brooklyn, all of which can be found at on my Facebook page, and I'll be getting notes up on the Blog Talk Radio page. Does anybody have any final thoughts that they'd like to share tonight?
Only thing I can say is that people should talk to their state legislators and make it clearly known that AOT is not a service, and it will not help people who have mental illness. It will not help reduce the things that they say it is, that they say it will. People that are homeless need housing. A pill does not make a home or a job or a friend. And it will only do one thing, is march us toward more of a 1930s America. And it makes everyone in America susceptible to having their liberty taken away.
Thanks, Yvonne. Any other closing thoughts from anyone?
Thank you, Laura, for having us and providing a forum for this discussion.
Ditto here, Yvonne. Ditto. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And so I've got 2 hours a day. If anybody would like to do a specific show on a specific topic and have the same type of format, please let me know. I'm very eager to get people signed up to doing this, and I think that we will reach people outside of ourselves, and we will educate the public on this. And I want to say, for anybody out there who may be contemplating what your situation is, and maybe this is the first time that you've been exposed to these kinds of things, you know, there's plenty of websites out there that have great information. Mind Freedom International at mindfreedom.org, the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights at psychrights.org. For Canada history, Eric, is there a specific website that you can
the
archive?
The archive website is great for learning our history, not only Canadian but American too. We've got a Mind Freedom collection. We've got stuff from the UK and elsewhere. It's psychiatricsurvivorarchives.com, and you can see it online.
Great.
If you look it up on Google, you'll find it.
Fabulous.
And Pat,
I just want to get Pat. We have 90 seconds left, but Pat, would you? You both have done a phenomenal amount of work. 500 plus pages of our history now. Would you tell people where they can get that and
email me, patrickrizzer@gmail.com.
Patrick Rizzer at what?
gmail.com.
patrizzer@gmail.com.
And that is
Patrick.
A phenomenal piece of Patrick Risser.
Patrick.
Sorry.
The website's Pat Risser.
Okay. The website's patrisser.com, and the email's patrickrisser.com. I'm sorry, patrickrisser@gmail.com. And so, you know, if you're out there and you want to voice something, you have something to talk about, you want to get your experiences aired, you have an issue that you think that we should be addressing, get in touch with me, laurentenny@aol.com, or on blogtalkradio.com /talkwithtenny. Again, I want to thank you all for a really lively and energizing discussion. We have a lot of work to do, and first on our priority is stopping the Murphy Bill. So pound stop Murphy Bill is the hashtag, #HR3717. Stop it today. Okay, thanks, everybody. Have a great night. This is Talk with Kenny, signing off.
Bye.